Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off here by breaking down the Browns' big Monday. Ben, Connor, and Jenny will come in to go through all the news. And as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome in. Week 8 is in the books. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. And we're going to kick things off here with the big news of the week, which without question is the shakeup in Cleveland. Head coach Hugh Jackson gone. Offensive coordinator Todd Haley gone. And there's plenty of blame to go around. You can blame Hugh for thinking that it would work with Todd Haley, for hiring Todd Haley, and for handling the situation and his staff the way that he has. Blame Todd Haley for being difficult to get along with. You can blame John Dorsey for signing off on all of this. But to me, I think the finger here has to be pointed at the very top of the organization, straight at Jimmy Haslam. And the reason why, this isn't the first time the Browns have been down this road. In fact, this is exactly the issue they've had since Jimmy Haslam got the team. And the problem with what happened in Cleveland over the last few weeks is that it was so foreseeable. In fact, if you want to go back and look at it, go back to 2013. Jimmy Haslam hires Joe Banner, hires Mike Lombardi. If you talked to anybody in the league back then, they would have told you that was not going to work. There was going to be a personality conflict. A year later, that thing blew up, just like so many people predicted it would. His next hires, GM Ray Farmer, head coach Mike Pettine, two guys who didn't know each other, two guys who, from a personality standpoint, didn't really mesh. And before too long, there were problems there, too. Then he hires Hugh Jackson and Sashi Brown, two guys with such different backgrounds. And the whole thing we were sold on was there's going to be checks and balances here. And there's going to be an old school approach here and a new school approach there. And it's all going to work together. And guess what? Before you know it, fingers are being pointed again. And then, most recently, in January, I can't tell you how many people looked at the marriage of Hugh Jackson and Todd Haley and said to me, how is that going to work? And so I think it's very easy to point fingers in this case. And again, there's a lot of blame to go around. But I'm pointing my finger at the owner because this has been a blind spot for Jimmy Haslam. Is he's matching the wrong people together. And not only are there warning signs internally, but if you look across the league, like bad relationships have taken so many organizations down. Indianapolis, Ryan Grigson and Chuck Pagano. San Francisco, Trent Baalke and Jim Harbaugh. Los Angeles, Les Snead and Jeff Fisher. We've seen so many organizations get into just a terrible rut because one side of the organization of the football operation isn't getting along with another side of the football operation. And I'm bringing Jenny and Connor now. He's making the same mistake over and over and over again. I think he's got potential as an owner, too. Like, from a business standpoint, they've done a good job. Like, if you talk to people in the room, they say Jimmy's made a real effort to be involved in the league level. But, God, I mean, like, it's the same thing over and over and over again. And they wonder why they're a circus. And you see Jimmy sitting up there and saying, we're not going to put up with internal discord. You invited it. And it was just, I mean, to me, like, look, I like both Hugh and Haley. Like, personally, I think anybody who couldn't see that coming just wasn't looking.
And I think he set up the dynamic too, you know, when he obviously Jackson and Sashi Brown didn't get along, but then, you know, bring John Dorsey in to, you know, make use of the draft capital that they had accumulated. But then you're pairing a first year GM with a head coach he didn't pick, who was already, you know, on thin ice, having gone 1-31 in the first 2 years. So you're already setting up a situation too, where there's, you know, everyone's on sort of different pages there. And so, you know, Jackson's in a situation where it, you know, his relationship with Haley is even more, you know, potential for fracture because Jackson's fighting for his job, right? Whereas if he were a first-year head coach, that pressure wasn't exactly there. So I think Haslam has been in this thing where he, you know, he's gotten this reputation of being too trigger happy and cycling through and continually hitting the restart button. But then he said, okay, let me try to give Jackson one more year because he saw through this, or he was at the helm during this rebuild period. And then he essentially set up another situation where that there was going to be internal discord because he and Dorsey weren't, you know, they weren't brought in at the same time and they weren't on the same page.
And Connor, can you imagine like being John Dorsey right now? And you spent all those years in Green Bay, right? Like working under Mike Holmgren and then working under Mike McCarthy and Mike Sherman. And then you go to Kansas City with Andy Reid and you're there with Andy Reid. Can you imagine being John Dorsey, like coming out of those two situations and then landing in this one? Like, what the hell is this?
I honestly think, and this is why I don't totally blame Haslam here, but I honestly think he's in the best position. And I don't think that he is worried or concerned at all, because if you watch that press conference yesterday, Haslam and every other reporter in there, anyone with any sort of sway that could affect the organization, treated him like the only adult in the room. And everybody's treating him like the only adult in the room. He's got it going forward. He's got the power, because clearly I think what Haslam is realizing, and you know, I think that you saw it in the line of questioning a little bit yesterday, is that he knows his limitations now. This was a mistake, you know, and he sort of waffled too much between, you know, making that quick trigger and then also trying to be pragmatic with the wrong guy. You know, I think Hugh Jackson was the guy who deserved the quick trigger instead of keeping him for an extra year. I think if he had followed the team close enough, Hugh Jackson is exhibiting signs of a coach that probably couldn't lead that building, probably couldn't, you know, be a unifier on the staff. And this was a year ago. This was two years ago. And so I think that you saw sort of an unofficial baton passing, at least in my eyes, that, you know, he's handing it to Dorsey and he's saying, you know what? I mean, you're the one guy that's nailed all your job responsibilities so far. The quarterback's good. The cornerback's great. You know, everything's good that you've done here so far. The free agents want to come here, at least, you know, you have some ability to recruit. So, you know, I think he's in a great spot. I mean, I think he's the only guy that doesn't have to worry about going anywhere.
No, I mean, I think Dorsey's on very solid ground now, and they get a little bit of a head start. Like, they weren't going to they didn't concede this. Like, we're going to spend the next 2 months looking for our next head. But logically, you have to think that the process begins now. And you put together a list yesterday. Is there someone you think that they should take a hard look at?
Well, I think just when putting the list together, you know, I think and this is what a lot of people have said, I think this is going to be one of the most unorthodox coaching carousels that we've seen in recent memory. You know, even at the beginning of the year, you know, we were saying that owners are obsessed with whatever's working in the NFL right now. And what's working in the NFL right now is sort of these dominant offenses, these kind of rocket fuel college concepts. And that means that, you know, I think that the stink from the Chip Kelly era has kind of worn off a little bit. A lot of teams are still doing stuff that Chip did in the NFL. Yeah. There was some stuff that worked there. And so I think that this is going to involve a heavy amount of legwork on there. And because it's not just the 10 coordinators that everyone's looking at the end of the year and saying, well, it could be this guy, it could be this guy. Like you had brought up, you know, Matt Campbell from Iowa State, Lincoln Riley. I mean, there's going to be guys that, you know, that aren't sort of in the norm. And I think that it's a necessity to extend the coaching search a little bit.
I also think that, you know, they're not necessarily looking for a person that can do every aspect of the ball, right? Like, you know, and Sean McVay is a great leader for that team, right? But he says, I'm focusing on the offense. I'm going to make the offense as great as it is. Wade Phillips focuses on the defense. Fossils focuses on the special teams. So that model, and obviously Sean McVay had NFL ties, but you can see how there's agents all the time that are matchmaking between coaches.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
you can see a college coach who maybe has Jimmy Sexton as his agent, and Jimmy Sexton has got a bunch of defensive coordinator candidates. They put together a package deal, offer that up to teams. That could be very appealing.
And I don't think, like, I think the mistake teams would make is looking for the next Sean McVay, because that's just not going to happen, right? Like there's just outside of maybe Lincoln Riley, like I just think looking for the next whoever is always a mistake, because you're always looking at somebody who's incredibly special, right? Like, and there's a reason why there's not 10 of them walking around available.
And here's another thing to keep in mind too, you know, which I mentioned yesterday, was just that This Browns job is going to come open, and you know whether it's Zach Taylor, the Rams quarterbacks coach, or maybe Matt LaFleur, someone from the McVay Shanahan tree is going to get plucked this offseason. Yeah. Is going to get an NFL job. But how careful are they going to be? Because knowing sort of the tight window that they have, maybe the one chance that they have to succeed, just like McVay did when he was so young and everything like that, are they really going to go to Cleveland at this point and make that their first chance at an NFL head coaching job?
John DeFilippo could be an interesting one. Now, he's not the McVay tree, but he is the Reed tree, and that's another one that's hot now. Matt Nagy's had some success in Chicago. Obviously, Doug Peterson's had success in Philadelphia. And Andy Reid assistance. I mean, I think this is about as fruitful a tree as there is out there as far as looking for guys that you're going to pluck as head coaches. And so, you know, DeFilippo's kind of an extension of that because he works for Peterson, you know.
Knows the situation in Cleveland.
And has done a nice job in Minnesota. I think he was born in Youngstown. Like, his dad was the AD at Youngstown State or something all these years ago.
Survived the Manziel era.
And he was, he knows what the score is there. And I think I think that's sort of a component, too. I mean, I brought up Matt Campbell. He's from Northeast Ohio. I think there is something to sort of knowing what you're dealing with there because it's a different type of situation. So, anyway, we've got plenty of time to talk about all that stuff over the next couple of months. We're going to get back to Week 8 here. I'm going to kick off the news items of the week. But first, I want to just let everybody listening out there know we are recording this at 12:31 Eastern time. The trade deadline is still 3.5 hours away. So if something huge pops on my train ride home this afternoon, I'm going to record maybe a bonus. This is cool. Here, we got this. A bonus news segment. This will be like news item number 6 or something. So if something huge pops, you guys will hear about it on the podcast. It just won't be right now. So our first news item of the week, the Rams stay unbeaten this weekend, edging the Packers 29-27 with a fumbled kickoff from Ty Montgomery, giving L.A. the breathing room it needed. Sean McVay's crew travels to New Orleans this week. There are two things that I think are pretty cool about this one. First of all, I think that the fact that they were challenged this way, I think, counts for something. And the fact that everything wasn't perfect, that Aaron Rodgers is on the other sideline and that's sort of hovering over everything, you know, and if you're Jared Goff, you can't tell me that isn't just there. You know what I mean? I have to outscore this guy. So I think that's one piece of growth that's nice there. The second piece, and this is something that Robert Woods told me after the game that I thought was really interesting. You know, sometimes you can tell when a coaching staff really has it working and we've seen this with Belichick in the past where it's something they bring up something during the week or something comes up internally during the week and then all of a sudden it shows up on game day and it's exactly I feel like you can always tell when a coaching staff really has it working that you see something like that. Robert Woods told me one of their goals for this week, based on the opponent, based on the spot, all of that, was to create a turnover on special teams. And I mean, there it is for you. And so it just feels like the Rams have everything working. I think out of this gauntlet, though, this is the toughest game. I think going into New Orleans, playing a Saints team that I think is maybe the most complete team in the league right now, is playing a lot better on defense, has talent on defense. It's not a fluke. It's not smoke and mirrors. They've got good players on defense. I think the Saints, they're in this the Rams are in this month-long gauntlet where they got to play, again, they got to play Seattle again. They got to play the Chiefs. They just got done with the Packers. I think the Saints, going to New Orleans and playing the Saints is the biggest hurdle they've got in that month.
It's a big test for a Rams defense that was inconsistent. I mean, obviously they were playing Aaron Rodgers, but there were definitely times when the receivers were just wide open. The cornerbacks were getting zero jam, just let the receiver fly right by them, or maybe they stemmed their route a little bit. And, you know, the go route touchdown that Rodgers threw toward the end to take the lead, I mean, that receiver was wide open. So it is a big test for a defense that has been good at times, but then has had flaws at times. You know, you saw Aaron Donald got that big sack, toward the end. So there's certainly times when you're everything's working. But I think the Rams defense has shown some vulnerabilities and now it'll be tested against Breeze.
You know what's interesting about that though, the Aaron Donald thing, is you almost feel that's why you pay Aaron Donald. Is if you look at the way defense is being played now, just based on the rules, the way offense is going, it's really hard to shut anyone down. And so it's almost I think teams are paying on the defensive side of the ball for guys who can make that splash play. In the Super Bowl, that Brandon Graham play won the game. like of all the plays the Eagles made, like the Brandon Graham, like it was whoever was going to get a stop first, like just one stop or make one play or create one turnover.
Or Hightower the year before in the Super Bowl that turned the tide.
Yeah. And I feel like Aaron Donald, like that's why you pay Aaron Donald $23 million a year, is that like he's capable of making that one play that can
when
turn
you really
everything.
Need it.
The other thing I thought was interesting about this game is, you know, not that Green Bay, I think, necessarily has the infrastructure, but, you know, I talked to a couple of coaches about, you know, a little bit about what the Rams are doing offensively and, you know, what defense can slow them down, like what can actually stop them. And that scheme that the Packers have had that sort of, you know, I guess that Rex Ryan deviation, the simulated pressures, using a few guys to create a lot of chaos in the backfield, that was really what a lot of teams are using as an answer, you know, at the college level and even at the high school level to stop a lot of these offenses. And so I thought that it was a good team for them to face at some point, you know, earlier, middle on in the season, because now they can adjust and now they can kind of move past it. And you saw a little bit of discomfort, but you talk about, you know, paying players. I mean, that's when someone like Todd Gurley makes all the difference. Where he can just rip his way through a defense no matter what it looks like.
That's interesting, though, because like so much of it's based on like, and you know, you like you hear Tom Brady say, like, you know, like, I feel like I've got the answers to the test. Well, remember the whole 15-second thing, like Sean McVay's talking to Jared Goff all the way down to the end of the play clock. And like, I almost feel like the Rams offensively, scheme wise right now, it's like with Brady, like if you give them the answer to the test, they're dead. You're dead. You know, like, because Sean McVay's been able to give those guys so many answers, you know, like, okay, this happens, you do this, this happens, you do that. You might like, that makes sense to me. Like that if a defense like that is not showing its hand or is good at disguising, like maybe that's the way you have to do it against what the Rams.
It's just that not a lot of teams have the, you know, that Green Bay is always, you know, it was an extension of what Dom Capers had done. I mean, remember Dom Capers was running that psycho defense in 2010 where there was one down lineman and everybody was walking across. I think it's just maybe not that it's coming back into fashion, but maybe coming back into usefulness a little bit. And they've had that personnel there forever.
Okay, there's a reason why I put this piece of news at number two, because it's something that Connor, I'm going to give him credit here, was on. Like you were like Nostradamus on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock because you called what was coming.
After four interceptions on Sunday, the Bucs benched Jameis Winston and turned to Ryan Fitzpatrick, who led a furious comeback. A day later, Fitzpatrick was officially named the new starter. And, I mean, you know, we've had our fun, I think, with Dirk Cutter at this point. But, I mean, all the cards are on the table right now. I mean, this is, I need to save my job. I need to win. And, you know, sort of disappointingly for Jameis Winston, it's gun to your head, who do you trust? And it's Ryan Fitzpatrick. And I think that there's really no other way to look at it.
You had a lot of fun with that on Sunday afternoon.
There's so many good Ryan Fitzpatrick gifts that come on the preloaded on the iPhone, like he's just like he's going like this already, and like if anyone sees I'm like shaking my fist furiously, but you know, he's just very gift worthy. He's a gift to some of us.
I mean, it was just like, this can't happen again, this can't happen again, this can't happen again. and then it's like, it's weird that something like that is predictable, that like this guy who, if you start him for more than eight games, you're in deep crap, right? Like that, it's so predictable that if you bring him off the bench, this is going to happen.
I mean, you know, you can question Cutter's decision making here, going back to Jameis, but Fitzpatrick kind of gave him that opportunity on the silver platter with that game in Chicago. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of players in the locker room who do believe in, you know, it seemed that way at least, that Fitzpatrick was there, you know, we can win more games with him. But then that game happens, right? And then you're like, all right, let's go to Jameis, you know. So I, you know, the reality is neither is a very good option, and the Buccaneers will be looking for a quarterback in the draft.
Well, I think the issue right now for them too is like, who's looking out for the long term, you know, fortune of the franchise. Because if I'm the owners now, like I'm probably looking at this and saying I'm saying one of two things, right? So that $21 million option is sitting there, and you're gonna have to make a decision on it in February or March, right? So I'm either, I need more information on Jameis, right? Like, so I'd like to see him play because I need more information on whether or not we should keep him, or, you know, like whether it's a new coach or Dirk, whoever's making that decision, we're going to need more information on him. Or I have all the information I need. He's benched, and now we need to put him on ice the rest of the year because we can't risk him going out there and having an injury that's going to trigger the guarantee.
Right. I think that they said, okay, we'll put Jameis back in there if he can win us games. Now that we know that he can't, we're going back to Fitzpatrick playing it safe the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Here's what I think is interesting. If you're another team, do you sign Ryan Fitzpatrick? Because does it not scare the crap out of whoever's in front of him? It's like the minute that I screw
up, it's unbelievable.
This guy's going to come in and throw six touchdowns, take my job for 4 weeks, and then give it back when I don't want it.
The weird thing is, like, the Jameis suspension and everything that's happened is like the second craziest of these. Like, there have been like five of them where he comes in and something happens to the starter, but this isn't even close to what happened with the Jets, where the starter literally got like uppercutted in the locker room by a special teamer and broke his jaw, and that's why Ryan Fitzpatrick was playing.
Was it an uppercut? Do we have that confirmed?
I thought it was an uppercut. Like a Street Fighter uppercut?
That's true, yeah, because if you broke your jaw, well, I guess it could happen in a lot of other places.
I think it was an uppercut. I think IK came with the uppercut. Okay, Jenny, news item number three.
The Giants fell to 1-7 on Sunday behind another shaky effort from Eli Manning, who coach Pat Shurmur wouldn't commit to starting after the team returns from its Week 9 bye. So this is complicated by the news that just broke. Connor, yet again, interrupted our recording for a Giants-related transaction that... related to an Eli on the team. Last week's was the Eli Apple trade.
That was Adam Schefter's fault.
Yeah. He thought it was Eli Manning being traded.
Yeah.
But Kyle Lauletta has now been arrested and was not practiced.
So, like, that was
traffic-related offense. We don't have all the details. That may change in the next 24 hours.
That's why I put that one in here, because I thought, like, we'd have a discussion about whether or not it's worth putting Kyle Lauletta in there and what do you do. And honestly, like, I haven't gotten the sense from anyone there that, like, they think that Kyle Lauletta has been this, like, revelation over the last 6 months. You know what I mean? Like, that they all of a sudden feel like they're getting more than they would with a fourth-round pick normally, and they got to put this guy out there and see what they've got. I haven't gotten that sense at all. And, I mean, this just sort of cements it. I don't know if there's really a reason to pull the plug on Eli. Like, I guess the only reason I can see at this point to pull the plug on him would be if he's playing so poorly. And look, I mean, Pat Shurmur, Mike Shula, those guys are the ones who know, like, how he's grading out and all of that, that you can't, like, effectively evaluate the other 10 guys. Because that's the position the Giants are in right now. Like, it's not about wins and losses anymore. It's about getting, like, a clean evaluation on everyone in the roster. And so if he's playing so poorly that you can't, like, evaluate the other guys, then maybe you make a change. But I don't get the sense that there's, like, this huge, like, urge to throw Kyle Lauletta out there and see what they have.
No, I think that that's just sort of he's sort of a victim of the market that he plays in, where everybody just sort of looks frantically for the backup or for other answers when it's a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, I think is there bye week this week or next week?
This week, I believe.
You know, I think that maybe the answer is just to really just have a long sit down with Eli and say, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to play next year? And if so, do you think that being here is going to help you be healthy for that, or, you know, be able to do that? Do you want us to announce that we're parting ways at the end of the season and let you say goodbye in a few different markets where there's a lot of Giants fans? Maybe that way it'll help us sell some tickets towards the end of the season. I mean, what do you want to do? And I think that that's really been the most unclear aspect of all this.
And we know, like, John Mara's pretty invested in the image of his franchise, like, pretty invested in how everything looks and comes off. And they want to be seen as, like, I mean, it's the same as the Ronies. You know, they want to be seen as, like, this Tiffany franchise that is the upper crust of the NFL.
Yeah.
And so my guess is that, especially based on the way it played out last year, because they got, like, a how-to and how not to do it last year, like in the way that Ben McAdoo and Jerry Reese handled it. Like, I would think, Connor, that there's going to have to be some sort of conversation like that to discuss, like, how the divorce is going to go down.
Yeah, and there's not really a great solution here.
I mean,
the way that things have unfolded, you know, if you had made the move a year ago, perhaps, you know, which they tried to, obviously, and then they got the backlash, and then they said, we're going to reinvest in him for one season. And now here you are in the middle of another season facing basically the same dilemma you faced a year ago and saying, how can we handle it differently when there really isn't a great answer?
No. Well, these things are... I mean, Eli saw his brother go through something much uglier than
and
this.
You don't have someone in waiting.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's
that's
not like you're not transitioning from Kurt Warner to Eli Manning.
And that's the issue. That's why like, and the Giants could find themselves in a really ugly situation, because if they are going to move on from Eli after this year, like, and then they could wind up pigeonholed into, like, we have to take a quarterback. That's the worst position to be in. Like, that's how Christian Ponder winds up going 12th overall, you know, is that these teams get in this position where it's like, well, we have to get one now, when the numbers would show us that there isn't necessarily a great one available every year. Like, there are going to be years where there's just not a great one.
If they can't, you know, shake someone loose, like, you know, and I don't think the finances make sense on someone like Derek Carr, you know, after this season,
right?
You know, and maybe Teddy Bridgewater, you know, commands top dollar on the free agent market. Maybe that's an age group that makes sense for them. But if they don't shake someone loose like that, I mean, you're talking about maybe wasting 2 to 3 years of Saquon Barkley's prime athletic years now on non-functional offenses. I don't know what Odell Beckham's thinking. He was already sort of passive in terms of his response if he wanted to be there. So, you know, I think that it's a lot bigger problem at this point. I mean, they've already assumed that they've owed Eli so much that they're in this pit now, and there's no getting out of it.
And that right there is why you don't take a running back second overall unless you're in a position to win right away. This is never about Saquon Barkley as a player. Like, Saquon's a great talent, and we throw the word around too much, but, like, he is truly, like, a generational talent. Like, he's a different type of back, like, I think a back for 2018. But there's an odometer on those guys. And if you're not in a championship window, it's hard to justify taking a guy who – like, maybe on the back end by the time you're, you know, really, really through with your rebuild.
And boy, the Giants should have done what the Jets did and buy low on Teddy Bridgewater. It was worth it. I mean, the Jets did that knowing they were going to draft a quarterback. I mean,
they took a lot of flack for that, too.
Their Jets plan was very sound.
Brilliant.
The Giants should have had, they know Eli's at the end, and they didn't do anything, essentially.
Brilliant. I mean, you look back at it now, they rolled the dice on Teddy Bridgewater's health. They brought in a guy in Josh McCown who could be a mentor to their young quarterback, and then they move up to get Sam Darnold. And in the end, having McCown there gave them the flexibility to move Bridgewater, which winds up landing them a third-round pick. Okay, news item number 4, the Cowboys fired first-year line coach Paul Alexander on Monday and promoted assistant O-line coach Mark Colombo, with Jason Garrett bringing trusted confidant Hudson Hawk back to help out. The reason I included this one, because that's not a sexy
offensive line coach transaction.
Surprisingly,
right. So the reason I bring this one up, the reason I put this one in there, is because I do think that it could have an impact on the NFC East race, which I think is still wide open. And to me, this is about reestablishing a strength in Dallas. And I'm going to say it right now: I think Dallas is going to be in the NFC East race till the end. And I think there's a good chance that we're going to look back at this move and say that this had an impact. Talked to a few Dallas people yesterday about this, and what they all said was, and I don't want to get caught in the weeds of offensive line technique talk or any of that, but the fact is that Paul Alexander came from Cincinnati. He was sort of brought up to coach massive offensive linemen who are playing gap scheme, like man scheme. And the Cowboys have athletic linemen who play zone scheme. And so I think it was recognized pretty early in the spring and the summer that, like, whoa, like, this guy's doing some different stuff, and he might not be getting the most out of this group that we've invested so much in. And so credit to the Cowboys for pulling the plug on something that wasn't working. Credit to the Cowboys for saying, we're going to go back and do what our players do well. And look, I think that the reason why I say I think this has a real chance to make an impact is because this is a strength of the team. The identity of the Cowboys runs through that offensive line. And if you can get them back where they were playing in 2014 or 2016, you know what happens? Well, now all of a sudden, Zeke Elliott's a different player. And if Zeke Elliott's a different player, now Dak Prescott's existing in a different environment where he has Amari Cooper. And we can argue until we're blue in the face about whether or not it was worth a first-round pick, but he's a good player. They're adding to a need position. And because they've been sort of existing in this functional environment offensively, the defense has had to improve. And so I think there could be a trickle-down. What I'm saying is I think there could be a trickle-down effect if they can get that offensive line back to where it's been.
And I think, you know, Garrett's job probably hangs in the balance of them staying in the NFC East race, right? So he makes this move. He makes the Cooper trade. They're saying, you know, we are expecting to be in the playoffs as the NFC East champion. And if that doesn't happen, you know, we talked about Riley earlier. I think Riley is someone that you really have to think a lot about for the Cowboys job because, you know, and listen, the last time the Cowboys hired a coach from Oklahoma, it worked pretty well for them. So, you know, we got to remember that history too.
Yeah. And I don't think like, I think like Riley is going to be careful because I actually think like the Oklahoma job is probably, I think if you ask most coaches, they would say the Oklahoma job is better than a lot of NFL jobs. Like
it may be better than the Browns job.
The money isn't different anymore. Like right. The money that they're making really isn't much different.
And better in a lot of
Right. And the job security is probably a little bit better. You have more control. You are picking what kind of players you want to bring, especially when you're in a place like Oklahoma. Like you've sort of got your pick of who you want to bring in, and you can build it the way you want it. And so I don't think Lincoln Riley is just going to jump at the first chance to do something. But Dallas might be one where he's from Texas originally. He grew up in like in West Texas, and it could be that one where, like, I can't say no to that. You know, I just can't say no to that.
And I think the really nice thing, I was thinking about this yesterday, like just from a human perspective, if you're someone like Lincoln Riley, you know that if you try and fail in the NFL, there's a nice cushion there on the other end, which is somebody's going to take you back at a high-profile job in college. We've seen that with Chip Kelly, Nick Saban, you know, any of these guys that tried to do it, they come back and there's a great, you know, $6 million a year job waiting for them somewhere else. And so I think that the fear there it has dissipated a little bit. Of course, you worry, though, about leaving the perfect place, which is Oklahoma the perfect place? Beautiful campus, hot recruiting area, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and so somehow we just went from saying the Cowboys are ready to bounce back to...
I pivoted. I was the pivot.
We went from the Cowboys rebounding to firing Jason Garrett in about three minutes
there. That was a reflection, though. That was a good observation by Jenny that we were too deep in the weeds on man-to-zone offensive line talk. Time to get a little more Lincoln Riley in here.
Good job. You pulled me right out of the weeds.
Better for the headlines. SEO-friendly.
There you go. All right. Connor, news item number five.
The Jaguars lost their fourth straight game on Sunday in London, falling to a tie for last in the AFC South with the 3-5 Colts.
The resurgent 3-5 Colts.
Yes.
I'm also pivoting again here, so I'm just going to let you get back to the topic.
No, I think that's a perfect place to start here because look at the rest of the Colts schedule. There's not a built-in loss remaining on their schedule.
I'm going to say it right now. I think the Colts might finish in front of the Jaguars.
Oh, I think the Colts could finish in the first place in the division. Yeah, I mean, I think today is going to be really interesting in terms of, you know, what the Houston Texans might do to fortify that roster and keep themselves in the lead and maybe do some things for Deshaun Watson. But man, I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, rising and falling teams in that division right now, until Leonard Fournette comes back at full speed, the Jaguars offense is just not what it was built to be.
The problem the Texans have is that their big need is on the offensive line. And right now, that's like where everyone's need is, you know, like, so like, I think the issue they have, you know, the trade deadline is like, there's just the supply demand curve there is way out of whack. I mean, it's why Nate Solder got $15 million a year. It's why Andrew Norwell is the highest paid guard. It's why Ryan Jensen's the highest paid center. Like every competent offensive lineman got paid last year. Like the Steelers' sixth offensive lineman got $7 million a year in Cleveland. And so the Texans are interesting. The Colts have the best quarterback in the division, I think, again. Like, I think he's right back there again. He's the best quarterback in the division.
And their offensive line is playing well.
Their offensive line is fixed.
Ryan Kelly is playing well.
I think it's more than playing well. I think it's fixed. Like, they have four top 40 picks starting now.
And they have a run
game. There's talent there. The run game, they run for 220 yards. I don't think they have allowed a sack in 3 weeks.
I was playing against Marlon Mack.
We're going to get there. I look at the Jaguars and there's just something like a little dysfunctional about them now. And the Colts have all these young players in the roster who, at least on paper, should like continue to get better. And I think Chris Ballard and Frank Reich have it going now. Like, I think that, like, look, I think they're still like probably a draft and a free agent class away. I think they're going to be a factor in the AFC in 2019.
Does this at all change the opinion of Ryan Grigson out there somewhere? Because a lot of these were his picks. And the butting of heads was always that I know how to pick offensive linemen, you just don't know how to coach offensive linemen. And, you know, so...
Well, Costanzo was Polian.
Was he?
Ryan Kelly was Gregson.
Ryan Kelly was Gregson.
Yeah. But I mean, like,
Gregson
had started getting the offensive line, like working on getting the offensive line fixed. So it did start under Ryan there.
So interesting point in the Jaguars. I did a little deep reporting on this now with a family member that lives in London. And I said, where could you go around where the team was staying and spend $65,000 on alcohol on a Saturday night in the wee hours of the morning? And she said, you'd have to try, really try, based on where they were. Now, maybe some Ubers involved and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, a little bit of escape hatch action with them. But, so there's a lot of interesting stuff.
I watched a clip from our former employer, Connor, the other day where I think it was Dion was saying that this whole thing was understandable because it's probably just a bunch of rookies getting stuck with the bill, and then the rookies decided they didn't want to pay.
Any rookies there.
It was a very interesting explanation of why it was okay for this to happen. Like at 4 a.m. on a Friday night in London.
Well, maybe they just
Dion was cool with it. Dion was cool with it.
Maybe they got confused about the time zone, like Geno Smith. They thought it was 11 p.m.
Speaking of time zones, it's always a good time to get to Connor for his fantasy update. And so what we got this week, Connor?
Well, I think that just after a week of despicable slander at the hands of, another insidery type podcast on another network and all that kind of stuff, I thought it felt really good to come out to get the W.
Oh, what you got there?
We're burying the football.
Wow.
And we're popping
a
little champagne today.
Wow.
Because we're back in this. No Dalvin Cook, no Leonard Fournette, but James Conner, no Matt Ryan because it's the bye week. Harry's guarding his head right now because I'm not.
You got to make sure you get the cork sound on the podcast.
So
do it close enough to the microphone.
No, there it is. See, he's actually got some. Is that champagne or is that?
So you can't.
Is that cider?
This is French alcoholic cider.
Okay.
Because you can't buy wine in this building, apparently.
Okay.
But,
this is a dry building?
This is for the bit. Yeah. So, anyway.
Anyway.
A little ice if people like it a little bit colder, but I think we're all going to celebrate here. We're 2-6, but I feel like once Dalvin Cook comes back, once Leonard Fournette comes back, we're a team of fighters. Last week, guys stepping up, Dede Westbrook out of nowhere off waivers, and we're going to keep grinding. Josh Adams is the big pickup this week. He'll be one of our stable of boys for next Sunday. So I've loved coaching this team, and I'm not ready to go.
I'll tell you what, you bring up Dede Westbrook, I'm all for it. I mean, those grimy, edgy type of guys with some skeletons in the closet, those guys are coming through through for me. I mean, this rogue band that I've put together, on a week-to-week basis, Joe Mixon coming up huge for me this week. DeSean Jackson, he's able to tune out all the trade rumors, puts up 19.5 points for me. I'm telling you, you have that edge in, your locker room, Connor. You have that edge in your locker room. Everybody's kind of – I feel like you play with a certain attitude.
We buried the ghost, man.
Yeah,
this is it.
No question. We're
burying the football. And another thing, I know we talked about hashtag release the texts.
Yes.
In terms of I'm not even going to call it a rival podcast because I'm not even sure, kind of what's going on over there. But
sounds like they're trying to draft us. How race cars try
exactly use us to build their brand. And I'm sure if you guys search hard enough on Google, you might be able to find it somewhere. But if we get another 5,000 subscribers over the next 2 weeks, I will release the text messages that prove that I was a victim of slander.
The receipts,
wow.
As they would say on The Real
Housewives.
I have
the receipts, hashtag.
Hashtag receipts.
I will.
Hashtag release the text.
Do we have a message we want to send Tom and Mike and Ian? Either of you guys?
Wow. I mean, just, that we're prepared,
He's prepared to release the text. So I think that we've got to
take that as a warning, Mike.
Yes.
I think it's incumbent now on our audience. If our audience wants to see the text,
right.
I think we're ready.
Let us know. And until then, we will enjoy this cider poured.
Hey, look, because I love all of you out there that have been listening to us. I love our audience. I'll tell you what, I'm even going to try to convince Connor after he releases the text here on the podcast to tweet out the screenshots.
So here we go. I'm just going to show this at a distance. These are texts that prove my point.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I just saw a line that was very incriminating.
Very incriminating.
Very incriminating.
I don't know, Mike. Your back might be up against the wall here.
My thought is that Connor just does things in an unorthodox way. You're kind of a wild card. I wouldn't want to mess with you. I mean, here you are toasting a 2-6 team. You're probably the first coach to pop champagne for a 2-6 team, but I am going to enjoy it.
It's
in the meantime.
It's hard to win in this league, Jenny. Hey,
you gotta find a way to build a better mousetrap. That's what I've done with my rogue group, and that's what Connor's trying to do by celebrating his second win in week 8.
Cheers. Cheers to Connor.
Cheers. Yes.
Cheers. Cheers. All right, guys. And we're going to get to your questions in just a second. But first, I want to tell you guys about the Hair Club. Now, I don't have huge issues with this, but I have friends that do. And your confidence is important. And sometimes one change can make all the difference. Hair Club knows this, and they're inviting you to become a part of the Hair Club family to see how getting the most out of your hair can change your life. They understand the emotions you're feeling and know the questions you have. Hair Club is the leader in total hair solutions with a legacy of success for over 40 years. Whether you're looking to revitalize the growth of your own hair or to learn more about the latest proven methods for hair replacement or restoration, Hair Club's professionally trained stylists, hair health experts, and consultants will craft a personalized solution to ensure you feel your best and get the most out of your hair. See for yourself just how powerful great hair can be. Telling you guys again, it's not my issue. I have fantastic hair, but I've got a lot of buddies who don't. They wear hats. They do all of this different stuff to try and restore their hair. This is your answer here. And because I feel strongly about it, my buddies who have to go through this, again, I don't have to go through it, but my buddies who have to go through it, I got a deal for you. Go to hairclub.com/Breer today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair kit, all valued at over $300. That's hairclub.com/Breer. That's my last name, B-R-E-E-R, for a free hair analysis and free hair care kit. Hairclub.com/Breer. We're going to get into the six-pack now. You guys know how this works. You ask, I answer. We're going to go rapid fire through your questions. Real quick, I want to give you guys an update. Demaryius Thomas traded to the Texans for a mid-round pick. My buddy Ian Rappaport, who we were just talking trash about, he was the first to get that out there. Certainly we mentioned earlier in the podcast, the Texans' biggest need was on the offensive line. This is a way to sort of get around that. They find a replacement temporarily, at least for Will Fuller. It makes some sense from that standpoint, helping Deshaun Watson out. Okay. You guys know how this works. Every week I put the call out for questions on Twitter on Tuesday morning. You ask, I pick six. If I pick yours, you get a like on Twitter and you get an answer here. Question number one from Garbellion. That's at Garbellion. Hello, Bert, of the Chargers and Chiefs. Who wins the AFC West? I like the LA Chargers as a more balanced offense and team. I like the Chiefs because I think the defense is going to get better, but I think this one's going to go right into week 16 and 17. I don't think the Chiefs are going to pull away. I think what you want to watch at the Chiefs is some of the younger players on the roster. O'Daniel, Speaks, Naughty, some of those guys. We'll see whether or not they do something at the deadline. I just feel like there's a bunch of guys on that roster that should be getting better on the defensive side of the ball over the course of the end of the year. Maybe they get Houston back. Maybe they get Barry back. I think they've got a chance to be a competent defense. And with that offense, I think all they need to be is competent on defense. But I like the Chargers, too. I think they'll be in the playoffs when all is said and done. Question number two from Cleveland Sports. That's at Clee Sports. Who will the Browns hire? 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 Thank you. Again, I'm going to go back to what we were talking about with Jenny and Connor. I think the Browns are going to cast a wide net. I don't think there are obvious candidates in the pro ranks, so I think they will look in the college ranks. A couple of names I would give you. Number one, and we're going to talk about him a little bit more in a minute, Mike McCarthy with the Packers. If there were to be a change in Green Bay, I think Mike McCarthy would be one that John Dorsey would consider. If you want to look at his Kansas City history, his Kansas City connections, Eric Bieniemy could be another one, the offensive coordinator there, the Chiefs, the guy who replaced Matt Nagy, who of course replaced Doug Peterson, he would be another one. So those would be the two pro coaches I would look at, with John DeFilippo perhaps as a dark horse. And then the college ranks, Lincoln Riley is the obvious one. I don't know that Lincoln Riley is going to go to Cleveland. Matt Campbell, I think the fit's there. To me, this makes all the sense in the world. They need somebody who's going to level out the program. I think a guy who's got program building experience like Matt Campbell does make sense from that standpoint. He's got Northeast Ohio roots. He's from Massillon, which is actually the hometown of Paul Brown. It makes a lot of sense if he can put together an NFL staff. If he can demonstrate that he can put together an NFL staff, I think Matt Campbell would make a lot of sense there. Also, I would tell you that John Dorsey, the circles that he runs in, there are a lot of guys that think very highly of Campbell. Question number three from Lorenzo Orsini. That's at Mr. Lorenzo Orsini. Does Mike McCarthy get the boot if Green Bay goes under 500 again this season with the Rodgers-led Packers team? Lorenzo, I think it would be on the table. And I'm just looking at history here. And if you want to look back at how Mike McCarthy got his job in the first place, this is sort of how it happened. Ted Thompson was hired in 2005. He inherited Mike Sherman. They went at it together for a year. Ted Thompson decided, and this was not necessarily the most popular thing in the world at the time, and certainly the quarterback, Brett Favre, had an issue with it. He fired Mike Sherman and hired Mike McCarthy. In 2018, what do they have? They've got a first-year GM who's holding over a head coach. So, I mean, McCarthy certainly has more pelts on the wall than Mike Sherman did in 2005. He's got a world championship there. And I think Mike McCarthy's a heck of a coach. But we've seen these situations in the past where a general manager will want to bring in his own guy and build his own program. So I don't think that it's impossible that something like that happens if the wheels come off in Green Bay. Question number four from Senny Wompers. That's at Senny Wompers. How much did Mayfield's feelings about Hugh factor into Jackson's firing? And could the same argument be made for Williams' chances of the head coaching job after Garrett's criticism? I don't think it was a huge factor. I think this was purely about the relationship between Hugh Jackson and Todd Haley. And I think that this was about the discord there and about creating a healthy environment for all the young players. Mayfield wasn't wild about Hugh. I know Mayfield, at least the people there say that he was pretty open about the fact that he didn't have a ton of respect for Hugh. So I do feel like, you know, that's sort of a side piece to all of this. To me, the overriding thing was creating the right environment for all the young players, for Baker Mayfield, for Denzel Ward, for Myles Garrett, for Jabril Peppers, for all of those young guys in that locker room. And it was impossible. It became impossible to do that with Todd Haley and Hugh Jackson working together. Question number five, Garbillion. I'm giving you two questions here. That's at Garbillion. Anthony Lynn has handled a lot of injuries. The Joey Bosa contract, the L.A. move, and the Bolts are in the playoff race. Yet again, almost no talk about his coaching performance, just like his team versus the Rams. He seems to be buried in McVay's shadow. Look, I think there's always going to be a fascination with the hot young offensive genius. And that's what McVay is. Like, that's what Lincoln Riley is to some degree. And so Anthony Lynn doesn't really fit that, but he has done a heck of a job. He has built a program that is able to sustain hits, and they've had a lot of injuries over the last couple of years. This year it's Hunter Henry, it's Joey Bosa. It's a resilient group that he's put together. And, I mean, we saw last year, we saw it with, you know, the L.A. move, spending half the offseason in San Diego, half the offseason, you know, in a temporary facility. Then, you know, they go through the 0-4 start, and he's able to get them into a position where they were competing to get in the playoffs in December, and we're seeing all that again. Anthony Lynn's doing a heck of a job. Question number six, last question of the week. Does D. Ford have a legitimate shot at Defensive Player of the Year? He leads all edge rushers in a bunch of PFF stats, including overall grade, pass rush grade, pressures, win rate, and pressure rate. D. Ford is a heck of a football player. No, he is not Defensive Player of the Year worthy. He's not that far off, but the fact that he doesn't play for a very good defense and the fact that J.J. Watt's playing the way he is, that Aaron Donald's playing the way he is, that Khalil Mack had the start that he has, I don't think D. Ford has a great chance of Defensive Player of the Year. What he has done, he's made a lot of money for himself. He's one of a group of pass rushers that's going to be out there. Group includes Ziggy Ansah, Frank Clark, DeMarcus Lawrence, Jadeveon Clowney. There are a lot of big-name pass rushers that are going to be out there on the market. And D. Ford has moved up that list and I think will make himself a lot of money when they get to the offseason. All right, I appreciate you guys coming out. As always, I welcome all feedback. We want to make this your podcast. You get me on Twitter at Albert Breer. I'm on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. And always remember to listen to all of our podcasts, the Gambling Podcast, Andy and Gary's podcast. You can get all of them in one feed now, the MMQB NFL Podcast. You can see us. You can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.